UK Wine Show, show number 196, Tim Hannay and Sensory Perceptions. Good day, my name's Chris Scott and welcome to the UK Wine Show. This week we're talking with Tim Hannay, the Swami from Umami. We talked with Tim about Umami and also part one of a two-part show looking at our senses at work. In the spotlight, I look at the possible genetic reasons why everybody tastes things differently, as well as the usual news and views from around the world. This week's been manic, absolutely manic. I've been trying to finish off some of my travel plans, and I've been absolutely swamped under a huge number of tastings this week, trying to sort out my trip, writing a massive report for a client on food and drink matching. I didn't think I could do so much. I think this week has been one of those weeks where I've been one of those highly efficient and effective people. Great, you say, but it's not going to last. I can assure you of that. I think next week it's going to be back to the normal. I hope, anyway. I've got some great interviews lined up in Hong Kong, and I'm still sorting some stuff out in New Zealand and New York for the podcasts, but I still have 2 to 3 weeks to go, so hopefully everything will get tied up in the next couple of days. Right, but let's crack on to this week's show, and let's start off with the mystery producer, who is named after the bay at the eastern extreme of the Wairau Valley, which was christened by Captain Cook on his voyage to New Zealand in 1770. The vineyards came into being in 1985 and was established by Cape Mentau Vineyards from Western Australia. The emphasis is placed on individual fruit character and the development of recognisable estate wine style. It's also committed to an environmentally friendly vineyard practices, and the company was a founding member of the New Zealand Integrated Wine Grape Production Scheme, set up to develop the program for sustainable vineyard management. Now, as usual, I'm going to give you the other clue just before the interview and then see if you can work out which producer we're talking about. But next up, we have the news with Jane.
Cheers, Chris. Latest figures show that for the first time, the British are drinking more South African wine than French. South Africa nudged ahead of France with sales growing 20% by volume to 12.27 million cases in the 12 months ending 23rd of January 2010. That's according to AC Nielsen data. This compared to a 12% decline in French wine sales to 12.26 million cases. The figures put South Africa in fourth place in the UK volume wine sales behind Australia, California and Italy.
People often ask me whether such and such a promotion is good value, and my answer generally tends along the lines of one offer may be generally good value, another can simply be a con. The general wine drinker has no idea about what's good value and what's not, particularly if they're shopping at supermarkets. One way to get a better idea is to follow exchange rates of countries. And as the pound sank against the euro last year, it was also strong against the South African rand, hitting a 5-year high in October 2008, which is when many of the wines are getting ready for export for 2009. Since then, the rand has strengthened, so the relative great value of South African wines that we saw last year is unlikely to be repeated. So I don't believe the South African wine industry is going to hold on to its lead against France. What's the next story, Jane?
Well, a new EU law that came into force in August last year has caught out Marks & Spencer with their Rosecco brand. The legislation was created to protect the name Prosecco, and now Prosecco can only be used as a term to describe a wine from the DOC and DOCG regions in Italy. Although Prosecco is in fact a grape variety, it can no longer be used by producers outside the region. So, producers making Prosecco from outside the DOCG and DOC regions will have to use the new grape name Glera, which is an ancestor of the Prosecco grape. Marks & Spencer is the first UK retailer to be hit by the new regulations, with 14,400 bottles of its Rosecco brand confiscated after being shipped from Italy.
I'm not sure if the Rosecco had the name Prosecco on the bottle, but it does look like Marks and Sparks were certainly trying to create the impression of Prosecco by simply dropping the P. Perhaps they were just taking the P, so to speak. Either way, it's going to cost them. What's the last story, Jane?
Well, sticking with grape varieties, Argentinian producer Mauricio Lorca in Mendoza has launched what it claims to be the first commercially available blend of Malbec and Torontos. It's called Malbrontes, and the blending of white and red grapes follows in the footsteps of the Rhone wines from the Côte Rôtie, where white Viognier is often added to Syrah. Australian winemakers have also created this style and called it SV or Shiraz Viognier. The new Malbec Torontes blend contains just 5% of the white grape Torontes, adding a light perfume note to the red wine, says UK importer Las Bodegas. The wine will retail at £8.99. That's it from me this week, but don't forget to check out these stories at our website 3050.co.uk.
Cheers, Jane. Well, blending a white wine with Shiraz, Viognier, only works if the grapes have been blended before fermentation. I don't understand the chemistry why, but they do need to be in the same vat to get that high fruit note that's quite nice with Viognier-Shiraz blends. And remember, it's only about 5% Viognier they put in there. The question for me is the blending of Torontes with a Malbec to add a floral note, which can be quite rose petally and almost Gewurz-like in aroma of Torontes, or whether it's to make the wine a bit cheaper? I don't know. Now, next up, I've got the spotlight. Now, I did promise to give you the book review, Natalie McLean's Red, White and Drunk All Over. However, I didn't manage to finish it this week, so I'm not going to review a book I haven't finished reading. I will finish it probably in the next day or two, probably on my flight to Hong Kong, and I'll write the review up then, and we'll have it next week in next week's podcast. So this week, I'm going to be looking at something a wee bit different. It's a piece I wrote on why people taste things differently, and it sort of fits quite nicely with Tim Hannay and looking at the actual sensory perceptions. So this week is, why do we taste differently? Now, it's often said that no two people are alike, and this is especially true for how people taste. Perceptions are created by nature and nurture, and genetic differences in the past have been driven by survival and in particular resulted in a sensitivity to bitterness. Plants that are poisonous do not invest energy in creating sugars that make them good to eat. Instead, they often use bitterness to discourage consumption. In our ancient history, humans have learnt to associate bitterness as an unpleasant sensation. And there is a natural distribution of sensitivity to bitterness. Some people are particularly sensitive to it, while others are less so. Women in prehistory who carried out more of the gathering roles and as such needed to determine the safety of foods gathered have developed a higher than average sensitivity to bitterness. That's not to say that all women are more sensitive to bitterness than men. It's simply that if you take a large enough sample, women on average are going to be more sensitive to bitterness than men. Now, plants that need to scatter their seeds often use mammals and birds to do so. When the seeds are mature, the fruit often changes colour as a visual signal, and bitterness and acidity decrease, replaced by the more enjoyable sugars. When humans taste something sweet, it can often mask residual bitterness or acidity. The seeds are ready, but maybe the acidity hasn't dropped enough or the bitterness hasn't dropped enough, so we've learnt that the sugar will hide it. When looking at population groups, there's a continuous range of sensitivity, but from an analysis point of view, it's often easier to group people with similar sensitivities. One classification system defines population into three even groups. The least sensitive group are called non-tasters, the middle group are referred to normal, and the third group are super-tasters. Now, last week Tim Hannay had his own version of this, and that's fine. Non-tasters have a low sensitivity to food and find many combinations acceptable. Normal tasters notice the bitterness and are likely to try and avoid them. Whereas super tasters are very sensitive to bitterness and tannins and tend to be very fussy eaters as a result. In an attempt to soften tannins, they tend to crave sugar and salt and often use that in their foods. Okay, I hope that's given you some sort of background into why people taste differently and also the bitterness aspect. Now, we're going to have the interview with Tim Hannay. He's going to actually be talking about umami and how our senses work. But next up, before we do that, is our mystery producer. And the second clue is, when most people think of this New Zealand wine producer, wine aficionados will often think of Sauvignon Blanc, the benchmark wine for this New Zealand producer, which is famous. However, they are not a one grape wonder. The Wairau Valley Wine Company at the northern end of the country of South Island also grows Chardonnay, Pinot Noir, as well as Riesling, Gewurztraminer and Pinot Gris in lesser quantities. The fruit comes from four estate vineyards and is also sourced from a small group of growers, some of whom have been growing grapes for the company for nearly 20 years to make the range. And the range also includes Pelorus and Tococo, a full-bodied alternative to Sauvignon Blanc. Now, That should give it away to most of you guys. If you're not, I will give you the answer after the interview, which is coming up next. Let's have a listen to what Tim Hanai has to say about umami and our sensory perceptions. Hi, I'm here with Tim Hanai from his NMW, and we're going to be talking about umami and also a wee bit about what's going on in your mouth when you're consuming products.
Sensory perception.
Sensory perception. Let's talk about umami, because umami's been attributed to the Japanese sixth sense. Is that right?
Well, so here's what it is. I'm actually the Swami of umami. 20 years ago with my scientists, they kept talking about a primary taste that doesn't fit in our normal paradigm of sweet, sour, salty, bitter. So it's a fifth taste, and it's actually, there's probably way more taste than that, but that's another complex subject. So consider, human beings can taste sweet, and we know what that is. We know what sour is with lemons or vinegar and whatever. We know what salty is by putting salt. And bitter, bitter's really a wild card, because some people, like we just talked about, are extremely sensitive to it. And a little bit of quinine or caffeine tablet, and it's, oh, that's horrible, while others are virtually incapable of sensing it, okay? Mm-hmm. But bitter's a little harder to distinguish.
That's tannins.
Tannin is astringency. Actually, tannin is touch, while bitter is a taste.
Oh, is it?
Yeah. How
do we people tie the two together?
Well, because they're usually present, and because we have these variables, one person actually might be experiencing the touch sensation of tannin, and somebody's actually experiencing it bitter because they're bitter sensitive. And so, again, the two people having completely, well, very similar. And what's really hard with bitter and astringent is, it's usually the molecular weight of certain compounds that are from the oak or from the skins and from the coloring. And so at a low molecular weight, if you're sensitive to bitterness, it's bitter. If they chain together, at some point they actually become a touch sensation. They denature the protein. Your mouth loses lubrication. We were talking about lubricity. So this is actually, then it becomes a taste phenomenon, because it gives that coarse, dried out, leathery feeling. Now, tannin is what is used in leather making to bind the proteins to preserve the leather. Yeah. And it's actually turning your tongue into leather momentarily.
Wines that are older, the tannins polymerize.
We think, yeah. An awful lot of times they don't, but yeah. So they, and so that's part of the process, is they go from bitter to larger chains, and then they fall out of solution.
Yeah, yeah.
Now, Pinot Noir is a wild card, because it doesn't have the same structure of color and whatever. It has only 9 of the color elements that Cabernet, say, has 23 of. And so it very often has this very bitter edge to the people who are hypersensitive.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Even though it's quite low in tannin.
Exactly. Exactly. And so if you're hypersensitive to bitterness, you'll be very, very picky about your coffee. You're picky about your food. So that's the picky eater, then the picky Pinot drinker.
Okay, let's get back to the mouth. Umami,
right?
Because that's quite an unusual one.
Okay.
What wines have got umami in it?
Well, let's start actually with what umami is. So it's a primary taste.
Yep.
As separate from smell or philosophy or anything else, it's a taste. The reason it has a Japanese name is because it was a Japanese science who over 100 years ago actually presented the concept to the scientific community, but the books were already written and they said, we don't want to add another taste. But it's interestingly, it's probably the most primitive and important taste humans can distinguish. And here's what it is. Think of the taste of a raw mushroom.
Yeah.
It's kind of nothing.
Yeah.
Just throw it in the microwave for 20 seconds and take it out, or put it on a toothpick and hold it over a flame. Don't char it, but when you cook it, it softens, but there's something new there that's really delicious.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And you've converted glutamic acid to glutamate, and we love glutamate.
That's MSG, isn't it? Monosodium glutamate?
No, MSG is sodium, salt, and glutamate.
Yeah, but it's a type of umami, is it?
Well, it is umami.
Oh, okay.
And there's hysteria, and this isn't pro or con, but humans love umami. Jamite, whether it's soy sauce, whether it's beans, we love it. Yeah. And a 150-pound human is 4 pounds of glutamate. Seriously, yeah, your brain wouldn't function without it. So then there's all the hysteria, and I'm not pro or con refined glutamate. I'll let you, you know, be your guide. But if you add tomatoes, ripe tomatoes to food, you've added glutamate.
Yeah,
So anyways, but the other thing is when you cook a potato, it goes, it's crunchy. Apples are crunchy and delicious, but potatoes are crunchy and not delicious. And it's watery and starchy. When you cook it, you actually convert ribonucleic acid to nucleotides. And that's the second important compound for umami taste. When you put glutamate and nucleotide together, you get up to a tenfold increase in intensity of umami.
Oh, okay.
Rice has glutamate, and it's not a complete protein, it's not a complete food. Beans have nucleotide, and it's not a complete protein, and it's not a complete food. When you put rice and beans together, as virtually every culture in the world learns to do, you get a complete protein, and it incredibly increases the umami taste.
Rice and beans?
Yes.
I don't do that very often. I think
and
I should.
Parmesan cheese and anchovies.
Oh, yeah. Parmesan cheese I have, but...
Well, Parmesan cheese is one of the highest sources of natural glutamate that you can add to food. So what we've done is whether it's Thai fish sauce or soy sauce or even Worcestershire sauce and ketchup and so on, we've got condiments, we've got ways of cooking and preserving food that satisfy our umami taste. Now, in the context of wine and food, sweet is the other naturally attractive, delicious taste to humans. Foods that are high in umami will make your wine taste bitter and unpleasant. Asparagus, scallops, certain ripe cheeses. We ripen and age the cheese to create more umami.
Yep.
And the more you do that, the more the wine potentially can take on a very unpleasant character. And again, salt and acidity are then the solution. So if you look at Ceps a la Bordelaise, mushrooms are really, really rich sources of umami. When you saute the Ceps, the Bolitas mushrooms for mushrooms a la Bordelaise, you're creating all this umami. You salt it well at the end of the sauteing. You throw in some fresh butter, some parsley, and lemon juice. So the addition of salt and lemon has more to do with the success of a wine and food combination than anything.
I always thought things like sherry and champagne had umami in them because their amino acids break down during the...
That's exactly right. And so when you get lusciousness and richness and whatever, the floor sherries are doing just like what Vegemite does to bread. They actually have the breakdown of amino acids for the glutamate and the breakdown of ribonucleic acids enzymatically for the nucleotides. And so yeast, when it autolyzes in the tirage of champagne, the longer you age it on the yeast, the more of the nucleotides you get, the more umami, rich, creamy. And same with lees stirring, and even same with red wines and maceration and whatever. So it's just a new understanding.
How much red wine has umami? Is that high or low? I always think of champagne as having champagne and fino sherry being high. And
It's a little bit more important more discernible in those two because you don't have the tan and the bitterness and the color and all those other things going on. So people have been trying to explain why an extended maceration of red wines, you know, the polyphenolic chains and whatever, but they haven't been able to prove that. So something's making the wine smoother and richer, and it's in contact with the yeast, so it is very easily that it's the umami taste that's causing that softening, that richness, etc.
But yeast takes quite a long time before it starts to break down or autolysize.
Oh, not long at all, no.
No?
No. As a matter of fact, well, you know, the whole Vegemite phenomenon is the human search for umami taste. After World War I, the farms and beef and lamb production disappeared, and they took to the practice of taking the leftover yeast from beer brewing and spreading it on bread. That's how Vegemite was invented.
Okay.
And it's to satisfy, and it's salty, and they salt it to preserve it, and it now has become a cultural phenomenon.
Okay. Let's check time. I just want to understand this completely because there's a bit of chemistry in there.
I know.
I do physics, not chemistry. You've got glutamate.
Yep.
And what the
nucleotides.
Nucleotides, and you need both of them to create umami.
Well, no. Glutamate alone will provide some umami.
Yep.
but it doesn't pop with flavor until you add the nucleotides.
Oh, okay, okay. Yeah. I've heard that when you're matching food, umami and umami reinforces each other.
No. What happens when you have a lot of umami in your food, your wine will taste thin and bitter. And that's, you need the lemon and the salt to readjust it to bring back the richness.
Is that a case of you getting used to the richness from the food, so therefore you're being desensitized to it from the wine, or is that a reaction between the food and the wine?
It's hard to go into in this. It's something called sensory adaptation, but it's the jumping. It's your brain trying to calibrate to benchmarks of sensory input. So when you get a lot of umami and then you have the wine, you can't taste the umami in the wine anymore. And we were doing this.
It's not because you just drank too much.
Yeah, when you lie, lying on the in the gutter face down, that's a whole nother phenomenon. No, but I'll take a white wine and sip it, and then take a little lick of lemon and try the wine again, and the acid disappears in the wine.
Yeah.
And do the tequila trick. Take a strong red wine, a little salt lemon on your hand. Try the red wine, lick it, try it again. All the tannin and bitterness disappears.
Oh, really? I'll try that next time I get a big, ugly Bordeaux.
I train chefs all around the world, 3-star Michelin chefs, Michel Trauma, winery chefs, are all part of this movement to literally eliminate wine and food matching in favor of, let me find a wine you love. My food is balanced with acidity, with salt, with umami, with sweetness, if any, and then compensated accordingly. And feel free to put some more salt on if you need it, because you know whether you need it or not. And then have the wine you love. And it's absolutely amazing. We had a dinner just the other night, a friend of mine who's literally been part of this for 20 years, and he's a senior person in Marriott, IB, and he's now working in Doha City. And so we were catching up, and we were with James and the Bibendum people, and we spent the whole night with Indian food ordering all the wrong wines, and then trying the right wines. And without exception, the wrong wines were typically more often delicious with the dishes than the right wine.
Yeah. I usually think like 80% of wine goes with 80% of food and 10,
there you go.
10 and 10.
And if 10 it doesn't, a little squeeze of lemon or lime, a titch more salt, and you'd just be absolutely amazed how little it takes. You're not overwhelming or anything, and all of a sudden what didn't work is now fine.
I hope you enjoyed that interview with Tim. I read about his work a couple of years ago and have been really keen to catch up with him for a number of years now. Next week, we're going to be finishing off looking at our senses with Tim. But before we finish up, how'd you get on with our mystery wine region? It was, of course, Cloudy Bay. Here are the clues again. Named after the eastern extremity of Wairau Valley, christened by Captain Cook on his voyage to New Zealand in 1770, came into being in 1985, established by Cape Mintail Vineyards from Western Australia. The emphasis at Cloudy Bay is placed on individual fruit character and the development of recognisable estate wine style. It also has a commitment to environmentally friendly vineyard practices, and the company was founding member of the New Zealand Integrated Wine Grape Production Scheme, set up to develop the program for sustainable vineyard management. We actually had an interview with the viticulturalist Siobhan quite a few shows ago if you want to catch up on that. But Kevin Judd is the winemaker and the man responsible for the evolution of Cloudy Bay's portfolio, including their iconic Sauvignon Blanc. The fruit comes from the estate vineyards and is sourced from a small group of growers, some of whom have been growing grapes for nearly 20 years to make the range. The range also includes Pelorus, DeCoco, as well as full-bodied alternatives to the Sauvignon Blanc style. Okay, that pretty much ends the show. Just to finish up this week, we have a quote. I actually took the quote from Natalie McLean's book, not by her, but by George Riddell from Riddell Glassmaking Company. And the quote is, "Life's too short to drink wine out of bad glasses." I agree with this, but I don't necessarily think you need to spend a lot of money on the Riedel glasses to get a good glass. Until next week, though, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Chris Scott and the news is read by Jane Scott. To listen to other shows, visit ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.